Matthew chapter 17, brothers and sisters, is where we left off last week. All right, join me in verse 9 of Matthew 17. It says, "And as they came down from the mountain, Jesus charged them, saying, 'Tell the vision to no man, until the Son of Man be risen again from the dead.'" That's verse 9. That's interesting, isn't it? I want to begin there. Maybe you've had some pretty profound spiritual experiences, intense times with the Lord where maybe a revelation, you know, was departed to you, and you've sensed his presence, you've heard him speak to you, he's shown you something that seems to you so amazing that the world needs to know. If you're there, then I guarantee you have a lot in common with Peter, James, and John as they're walking down that mountain. And then on top of that, you know the deal, and it comes up, I think, in our study this morning. There's a constant debate among the disciples of the Lord. Who's the best? Who's the greatest? And I assure you, Peter, James, and John are walking down from this mountain having seen something none of the other disciples have seen. Jesus transfigured in front of them. And they're thinking, presumably, "I cannot wait to tell the guys about this. We got brought on the inner circle. We have seen something. We've seen Moses and Elijah. We've seen Jesus, you know, transfigured, glorified." Clearly, Jesus brought us up at the top of this mountain because of just how amazing we are, right? He's revealed some things to us unlike the rest of them. And that's a good place to start. First of all, when the Lord does share things with us, whose glory is that for? Clearly, this whole vision was all about the glory of Christ. "I don't want you to tell anybody about this until after my resurrection." He wanted the world to know this about him. That's why we have it in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. That's why Peter wrote about it in his epistles, just so you know. They were very faithful to tell us about the transfiguration and what they saw on, as Peter described it, that holy mount. But it's about the glorification of Christ. We have spiritual experiences, and they very easily become about the glorification of self. We talk about our fasting experiences. We kind of flex in the flesh about spiritual things. And what's really interesting to me, Jesus here says, "Listen, I don't want you to tell anybody about what you just saw." You got that, boys? And I suggest they're going, "Nobody? Man." And think about that, guys. Is there ever a time when God shows you something, it's not for the world to know? It's just for you. It's just something sacred and holy and intimate. I do believe sometimes the church really lacks discretion. And we bleed and blab everything that God shows us. And I'm sorry to use this illustration. I've used it before. It's kind of like intimacy, in a marriage. That's not for public ears, guys. There's intimate acts that happen between husband and wife. It's for them, right? And it's special only when it's for them. But when it becomes a thing that we broadcast, it really takes away from the sacredness of it and how unique and special it is. Are you with me? And there's a whole denomination of Christianity, I believe, that's what they're known for, sharing everything intimate that they experience with the Lord week after week after week till it becomes mundane and common. Jesus commanded these men, "That was for you guys. That cannot come up even once till I'm out of here and I've already resurrected and ascended." I think that's very interesting. I would just ask us to personalize some of that. Man, to keep those times of being in the Lord's presence, sometimes we need to keep them sacred and holy and use some discernment and some discretion, I believe. Certainly that's what's going on here. Okay, so that's a dead issue at this point. Verse 10 says, "And the disciples asked him, saying, 'Why then say the scribes that Elijah must first come?'" I'll go on. "Jesus answered and said unto them, 'Elijah truly shall come first and restore all things.'" So what are these Jewish men asking Jesus? They just saw Elijah. And as a Jew, that's kind of exciting. That's kind of exciting based on what they've always understood as young Jewish boys growing up in Israel. They were always under the impression the scribes, the experts of the law, would tell them, before Messiah comes and establishes a kingdom, Elijah's going to return again. Elijah's going to come back. And if you're familiar with your Bible, you know, and we'll probably go there in just a moment, the Old Testament literally ends with that promise. Elijah's going to come back before the great and dreadful day of the Lord, right? And he's going to restore the hearts of the children back to the fathers and the fathers to the children. He's going to be used by God to bring a revival in Israel and reestablish Israel to its former state. What's fascinating about that is Jesus verifies that. Oh, no, that's true, guys. Hey, Jesus, why does the scribes teach us that Elijah is going to come back? Is that what we just saw? Are you this Messiah that's going to establish a kingdom and restore Israel to its former state, its glory days, when King David, for example, was on the throne and we had no enemies anywhere? Are you doing that? Is that what we're seeing? And Jesus says, and I think this is very, very important for us to understand, and it has a lot of theological implications. He says very clearly, truly Elijah shall come. Shall first come. That is future tense. This hasn't happened yet, but it will happen. Truly it will happen. Now, that's from the horse's mouth, guys. That's from the Creator himself. Jesus said Elijah will come. Now, don't be confused. Some people want to make that statement about John the Baptist. Make sure your chronology is proper. John the Baptist, as of right now, when Jesus said it, had already been beheaded. He's already gone. So he's saying this prediction is still on. It's still valid. He will come and restore all things. Restore all things. He will literally bring Israel back to its former glory, former state. That's from Christ himself, church. I don't know if that's debatable. There's a lot of theology out there, a lot of good theologians that would suggest to you and me God is done once and for all with Israel. And somehow Israel is kind of like morph into the modern day church. Don't look at Israel anymore like God's going to ever do anything there again. God's done with Israel. He's wiped his hands of them. But all those promises now apply to us, the church. What? Well, to take that position, you really got to start unraveling some very clear black and white things that Jesus said. He will return, truly, and he will restore all things. Bring Israel back to its former state. You know, you have to, if you take that position, and of course I'm referring to the amillennialist position or the preterist position. If you're into theology, those words mean something. If you're not, they don't. But I'm just suggesting there's a whole world out there of good Christian people that suggest, don't worry about Israel. It's just smoke and mirrors. God will never do anything significant there again. There's no literal kingdom God's going to establish in Israel. Don't even pay any attention to it. That's interesting to me. Well, if you are that person and you're here this morning, then you have to wrestle with this. I don't. I actually believe this still applies. When is Elijah going to come? When is he going to restore all things? Apparently, Jesus was wrong about that. I think he got some issues there myself. But certainly some things to consider and think about. But then he goes on to say something about their present day. Jesus is saying, no, that's true. In the future, that will absolutely take place. In the latter days, as it's spoken in Malachi, you might want to read the last few verses of the Old Testament to get the real proper context. But Jesus goes on and says this in verse 12, but I say to you that Elijah is come already, obviously in a figurative sense, because he says he's going to come eventually, but he's also come already, and they knew him not, they didn't recognize him as Elijah, but have done unto him whatsoever they wanted to. Likewise shall also the Son of Man suffer of them. We don't have to wonder what he meant because it says, then the disciples understood that he spake unto them of John the Baptist. And just like this same account in Luke's gospel tells us that John the Baptist came in the spirit and in the power of Elijah. So he was a fulfillment of that prediction in their present age. And that's not uncommon either. It's not uncommon for prophecy to have a dual fulfillment. You do know that, right? You got Jonah, for example. Jesus said, you want a sign? Just as Jonah was in the belly of the fish, that actually spoke of me being in the heart of the earth 3 days and three nights, speaking of his resurrection. And there's so many instances where you have a narrative in the Old Testament and it's fulfilled in the immediate present, and then it also has a fulfillment that is yet future for the last days, and certainly this is no exception to that. So John the Baptist came, the same Spirit of God that was upon Elijah was upon John, the same influence he had over his people, John had. He even had the same uniform, you do know that, right? Camel's hair and a leather belt, spitting image of Elijah. No doubt Elijah was John's hero, very confrontational, very much emphasized the wrath of God, and John the Baptist came in the spirit and the power of Elijah. So Jesus is saying, if you can handle it, guys, that's happened already in this dispensation. And they understood him to mean John the Baptist. Interesting stuff. As we continue down the mountain, verse 14, it says, when they were come to the multitude, there came to him a certain man, kneeling down to him and saying, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is lunatic and sore vexed. For oftentimes he falls into the fire and oft into the water. I brought him to your disciples, and they could not cure him. Then Jesus answered and said, oh, faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer you? Bring him to me. And Jesus rebuked the devil, and he departed out of him, and the child was cured from that very hour. Now, before we get into the specifics of this, it's been stated, and I think it's absolutely accurate, that with every, you know, mountaintop experience, at the base of that mountain, you're probably going to have a devil that you're confronted with. You know, if our whole life was mountaintop experiences, guys, we wouldn't appreciate mountaintop experiences. Have you ever thought of that? If we literally just leapt from mountaintop to mountaintop, we would start to become spoiled rich brats, right? Expecting everything we do, every corner we turn, to just be an amazing moment with God. But he wants us to have some strength. He wants us to feel a little resistance, right? He doesn't want to just make a bunch of welfare recipients with our spiritual hands out, with an entitlement mentality and an expectation. You would agree. So guess what? In the real world that God has called us to, there are these mountaintop experiences where we couldn't feel more close to God, right? And we have these amazing epiphanies, and God shows us things, or there's victory over sin, or what freedom from bondage. That's very important, and I hope you've had those. As you walk with God, you will have those. There's no question. But here's the reality. You got to come down off that mountain at some point, and what we're typically confronted with in the valleys is the darkness of this world, right? And the human desperation of this world. And that's certainly the case here. As these men are going down that mountain, they're hearing about the messianic age, the kingdom. They're licking their chops. They're so excited. They can't be more thrilled. Let me ask you, are you in this room this morning, are you in an idolatrous way, dependent on those moments with God to carry you spiritually? In other words, if you don't feel a mountaintop experience this morning, has God failed you, or are you going to abandon your post because of that? Or do you realize that's the way it works, brothers and sisters? There's valleys, man. There are devils that we have to war against and fight against. There's resistance against the truth. There is darkness in this world that seeks to snuff out the light. Wednesday morning was never more of a reality of that in my world than in recent history. Waking up Wednesday morning, just realizing the whole country has voted. In my mind, sex is our God, and we prefer sex without consequences. I don't care about anything else. Blows my mind. And that's my strong, microphoned opinion. The God of America is sex, and I believe we just communicated that by the casting of a vote. That's what I think. You know, you vote at the door here. But that's what I think. And I think it's obvious in our nation. That's where we're at, truthfully. There are devils that we compete with. There is darkness. And as these men came down the mountain, they're wanting to just go from joy to party to greater celebration. But whoa, they have a kid who is scarred, burned, barely alive because he is so vexed with the devil. This devil is violently trying to destroy his life. Think about how horrible that looked and how terrifying that is. My goodness. Not just a typical demon-possessed individual, but this devil has been literally torturing this kid, throwing him into fires as he walks by them, or whatever the case may be, completely in control of his motor skills. This term in my old English Bible, lunatic, it kind of lost its meaning to us. It was actually meant more literal back then. Moonstruck. There was something observable when the moon is full. Everybody seems to act a little different, right? And that's the idea that this kid is moonstruck. We beef up security all over the country. We beef up security in prisons on full moon nights. There is something to it. You could roll your eyes and go, oh, please. You know, superstition, this and that. I don't know. And I don't pretend to know all that is involved in the spiritual world. But I do know that there seems to be an increase in bad stuff that happens when the moon is full. True story. There's that. Well, the parents of this child are assuming something is connected, and maybe that's because of the frequency of those particular moonlit nights where he's particularly tormented. Now, this father had clearly heard that the disciples of Christ have been successful in casting out devils, and they imagine the desperation of this parent. Imagine watching your child be tortured like this. It must have been horrible. And to bring their child to the people of God, the disciples of Christ, and they try out their Ghostbuster guns, and they're out of ammo completely. And this devil laughs in their face and continues to torment this kid. Imagine the humiliation. Imagine the intimidation that would cause among the disciples of the Lord. And they told them that. They told Jesus, your disciples are powerless against this. Man, I think about that. The needs of our world and people coming to the church and finding that the disciples of Christ are powerless to affect in a positive way. I pray that that's not the reputation of the church here today. All the desperation of humanity and people coming, all right, let me try church. I've tried everything else. And then even in church, they don't find change. They don't find solutions. They don't find hope because the churches of America have been turned into entertainment arenas, sideshows and big lights and smoke and a lot of amazing music and a shallow emphasis on experience and no meat and potatoes, no substance whatsoever. Faithless in so many ways. Even with an emphasis on, humanism and not at all Christ. It's true, sad but true. And Jesus answers and says, oh, faithless and perverse generation. He loves these men, but he's not necessarily saying anything that's going to, make them feel good about themselves. He says about the people all around him, disciples included, faithless and perverse. And then he says, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I, the idea is, put up with this? Jesus said that. If you have a Mr. Rogers version of Jesus where he only said kind things every time, it's not accurate. He's actually very disgusted with humanity in this instance. Oh my goodness, you've got to be kidding me. Faithless and perverse generation. How long? No doubt saying it kind of tongue-in-cheek to his father. Do I really have to stay here another day? I'd really like to go back home where things are right. This world is broken. And we would amen Jesus on that statement. Yeah, it's broken. It's faithless. It's perverse. A holy God, for the record, as good and gracious and obedient as Jesus was, a holy God never likes to hang out among faithlessness and perversion. It was very good of Christ to be among us. It wasn't always thrilling for him to be here. I think that's good for us to hear. Jesus rebuked the devil and, he departed out of him, and the child was cured from that very hour. Don't you love the power of Christ? I mean, all the effort, all of the desperation, Jesus, bring the kid over here. You, devil, get out of here, you little punk. I mean, we don't have the exact quote. He rebukes the devil and casts him out. I love that, the authority of Christ. You know, his eyes were wild, right? You know, he wasn't, hey, little guy, you get out of there or else I'll send you to the abyss early. I don't know what he said. But that little devil, in comparison to Christ, ran off with his tail between his legs, having been confronted by the dog catcher, right, with a big club. I love the statement that this makes about our Lord Jesus. And that kid was cured from the very hour. That's right. We don't need the people of God. We don't need church leaders. We need Jesus. He's the difference, okay? He's the one that we need. In an ultimate sense, very real sense. Okay, that was a real blow to the pride of the disciples, as you can imagine. It says in verse 19, then came the disciples to Jesus apart and said, why could not we cast him out? They're really confused, but a couple things just to notice. Do you notice the disciples waited until the multitude kind of dispersed? They get private with Jesus. There's obviously some defeat here. There's obviously some failure. And the disciples, when it's about their own failure and defeat, they want that circle as small as possible. They don't want to mention this in front of all the fans. They didn't immediately go, what? Are you kidding? How come we couldn't do that, Jesus? And then Jesus would have said in front of everybody, your unbelief, that's why. That's Thomas, Philip, because you don't believe in me, that's why. That'd be very humiliating. They waited for the multitude to disperse and got very private with, hey, what happened? Tell me what happened. How come I'm such a miserable failure as a minister? And I bring that up for this reason, guys. We want our own failures and our own defeat to be handled in a very private and discreet way, don't we? But what about when it comes to the failure of others? I don't mind exposing it. I don't mind yelling it from the housetops. Do you understand the heart behind what I'm suggesting? And by the way, if we're going to have success with people that have been experiencing defeat or failure, guess what? Jesus said, go to that person privately, Matthew 18. Go to them privately and seek to win them very privately. If you've restored them, case closed. You don't then go, guess what? This guy was living in adultery, but I talked him out of it. What? No, you've successfully won your brother over, there ends the matter. If he refuses to receive, then you get more people involved, and that kind of escalates to the point where you might have to, you know, exercise church discipline. But I think we forget this sometimes, how much more effective our correction and discipline is when it's done in a private way, private setting. My pastor always said this, someone who is motivated by love always seeks to keep the circle as small as possible. That seems right to me. Let's keep the circle as small as possible. We only let people in that need to be. Do you understand? And that always had a ring to it of truth to me. And I believe that it's in line with what we see in the scriptures for sure. So they bring Jesus apart very privately, and they ask him, why could we not cast him out? And Jesus said unto them, because of your unbelief. I have a theory. I think it's warranted. I think they saw how grotesque this particular case was. I think they saw how aggressive and violent this demon was. And if you can hang with me, I think there were sounds and an experience associated with all this that was extremely intimidating and very sensational to their senses, right? And in that, whoa, what? No, I've never seen anything like this before. It caused them to focus on the issue at hand and forget about the power and the greatness of God. That's how our enemy would have us live, by the way. They want to be really loud and overbearing, lots of threats, lots of violence, lots of stimulation and overload that gets us fearful and focused on it and forgetting about the power of God. It's called the terrorists. There's no greater terrorist than Satan himself, right? He wants to instill fear because as soon as we get into that fear mode, we are no longer faith-filled. I think that's what Jesus is saying. You guys didn't really believe. We've done this before. Yeah, you were relying on your past experiences, not me. And you were really freaked out by the snarling and gnarling of what you were looking at, and you forgot that I am the one that does these miracles, not you. I personally think that might be accurate to what really took place. I don't know if you've ever experienced this. Again, I've traveled all over the world, but I've seen things like this in Down East Maine. Not to be dramatic, but I remember over at the gun shop, me and my brother Brian Campbell were lingering, you know, just him and I, long after everybody had gone home on a Sunday morning, and somebody kind of doubled back and came into the little gun shop, a 65-year-old man. And as soon as he pulled in the driveway, things were not right. And Brian and I both had the same kind of discernment, like, this guy is off. And it became very quickly obvious, this man is riddled with something outside of himself. And as we began to pray for him, there was all kinds of broken furniture at the little gun shop. This guy was being tossed all over the room, and I don't know if that's dramatic. I saw it. It was extremely intimidating. And I think I've lived this. I think I've seen something very similar. And as he got himself together and thanked us for the prayer and went down the road, Brian and I looked at each other like, what was that, man? Now, it wasn't your typical Sunday afternoon. I'm usually eating potatoes and roast by now, right? I didn't expect that. So, brothers and sisters, this can be a very intimidating thing. In many similar situations in India and Honduras, and the devil's real, there's no question about that. Jesus says something very interesting here. Your unbelief is why you couldn't. If you have faith, he goes on to say, as a grain of a mustard seed, that's the smallest amount of faith, then you shall say unto this mountain, remove hence to yonder place, my old English Bible, get out of here and go over there, and it shall remove, and nothing shall be impossible unto you. Howbeit, this kind goes not out but by prayer and fasting. There's a whole lot there. Jesus is, you know, opening up a whole world of possibilities if we're motivated by true, authentic, and biblical faith. By the way, it's not the faith to make my own kingdom better. It's the faith to make Christ's kingdom advance. So please understand, we're not talking about buying Ferraris by faith, right? Or living in mansions by faith. That's my kingdom. That's not what Jesus is teaching. That is impossible for me to have a Lamborghini. I've accepted that. That's impossible. It always will be. Okay? And if I ever obtain one, I promise you, faith had nothing to do with it. I promise you. You should call the cops. Yeah, that's the truth. But the impossibility that I think we're dealing with here is about the advancement of God's kingdom and what seems in the kingdom of darkness to be such an impossible hurdle. You ever feel like that? You look at the world like, it's impossible, God. It's impossible to make inroads in a world that believes this. They don't even believe in truth anymore. How do you argue or debate with somebody or reason with somebody that doesn't even believe in truth being absolute? It looks like some major impossibilities, right? And hear the Lord say, faith. That's how. Faith. You can move mountains believing and trusting in me and my word. I think that's a good reminder for me this morning, for sure. But then, this kind, he says in verse 21, which is a really interesting statement. This kind, speaking of different kinds of devils, this kind cannot be cast out except by prayer and fasting. Yeah, Jesus definitely taught that it's not a one-size-fits-all when it comes to devils, guys. It's not just a little minion devils that are all the same and they're equal in influence and power. Jesus is actually teaching us here, and the Bible agrees in other places, there is a hierarchy of devils, different ranks, different positions, different influence and strongholds. And this particular devil, apparently the disciples of our Lord had not faced anything like this up to this point. And it's only by prayer and fasting, that's really coming out of a time where we're completely glued and fixed on God with this kind of devil. Speaking of his influence and his stubbornness, I suppose. Whole Bible study there if you think about it. Pressing forward, verse 22 says, "And while they abode in Galilee, Jesus said unto them, The Son of Man shall be betrayed into the hands of men, and they shall kill him, and the third day he shall be raised again. And they were exceeding sorry." Which tells me once again, they didn't hear the raised from the dead part. They just fixed on die, the Messiah die. And this is the third time he's told them this. And the more they hear it, the more dejected and discouraged and confused they become. How can the Messiah die? They're just grief-stricken at this point every time he says it. But the truth is, he's preparing them for what's ahead. When they were come to Capernaum in verse 24, they that received tribute money came to Peter and said, "Does your master pay tribute?" And he said, "Yes." And when he was coming to the house, Jesus prevented him. Before he could speak, Jesus says, I was there. I know what just happened. Let me ask you a question. What do you think, Simon? Of whom do the kings of the earth take custom or tribute? Of their own children or strangers? Peter said to him, strangers. And of strangers, Jesus saith unto him, then are the children free. Okay, what's going on? Before we look at the rest of this, what's going on here? The leaders of that area come up to Peter and say, all right, you know, your rabbi is teaching you guys contrary to everything we believe. You guys pay your tribute to? And instantly, impulsively, which is, you know, certainly characteristic of Peter, yes, of course we pay our taxes. Of course we pay tribute. And he's going to run home and tattle on these men. You wouldn't believe these guys, Jesus. As soon as Peter walks through the door with his finger in the air and his mouth open, Jesus goes, Pete, let me ask you a question. When it comes to, you know, king's tribute money, what do you think? You think a king would charge his own children? Or does he just charge the foreigners that come into his area, the travelers? Pete's like, well, the travelers, of course. Well, shouldn't the children be free then? What's he saying? You think it's right to charge the Son of God a fee to go into my father's house, Pete? What do you think about that? Shouldn't the children be free? And he's challenging the idea that he's being charged to go to his father's house. I think that's a valid point. In other words, in light of my position, I have the liberty to avoid this in light of who I am. But of course, and this is the part that I think is awesome, of course, Jesus doesn't collect on that liberty. Neither should you and I all the time. Just because we're free to do something, just because we can justify a certain thing, of course, we're motivated by love once again, right? It's not about me. It's not about what I can get away with or I shouldn't have to because I know this or whatever. It's about offending people, and it's about the reputation of my Lord ultimately. My actions reflect upon my Lord only every time. So I love how Jesus kind of wraps this little lesson up personally. He says, notwithstanding, verse 27, lest we should offend them. He didn't want to do that unnecessarily. Go to the sea, cast in a hook, take up a fish, the first that comes, and when you've opened his mouth, you'll find a piece of money. Take it and give it to them for me and for thee. It's just so matter of fact. It seems crazy, right? By the way, if you come from a background that teaches that Jesus was wealthy because of his faith and they just, you know, just a rich group of guys, why wouldn't Jesus go, take this and give it to him? He didn't. He said, here's what you do, Pete. The lake's right there. Take your pole, you know, take your ugly stick and whip it out there, right? The first fish that you get, open its mouth, there'll be a coin in it. You know, pay my tab and pay yours too. You're welcome. And you know, Pete walked out of that house like, what? It's the craziest thing. And this is just a theory. This is just me. I know you didn't come here for me, but I'm just throwing it out there. Just a few chapters before this, just a couple chapters back, you guys remember Peter walked on water, and then he fell and he was drowning and Jesus came and rescued him? I just have a theory, because I've seen a lot of coins from Jesus' era going to Israel. You can find them. They've been dug up. You know what's cool about the coins of Jesus' era that are very different from ours, you know? No two coins are the same. They didn't have a mint, right? I just have a theory that when Pete got back in the boat later on that night, he's like, no way, my shekel, I must have dropped it in the lake. I just have a theory that he picked that coin out of the fish. Get the heck out of here. Just a theory, just throwing it out there. I personally think there's something more to this than meets the eye. It seems a little bizarre, but anyway, food for thought. There, chew on that one at lunchtime today. Chapter 18 goes like this, and we're about 5 minutes from finishing, but we'll close with this morning. At the same time came the disciples unto Jesus, saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And before we look at his response, let's consider that. Why in the world do they care? Well, because we care, right? Because we care about such important things. Greatness of man, our successes, our reputation. We care about this. And this was actually a debate that was going on nonstop among the Lord. And they've actually had enough of debating. It's exhausting. You know how it is, right? So they're just going to go to Jesus himself and say, "Will you just settle it for us? Who is the greatest?" And they're waiting like some forge and fire. You are the forge and fire champion. They're waiting for something like that, right? There's 12 to pick from. Peter. But Jesus looks right over the top of these clowns' heads and goes, "Hey, you. Hey, yeah, little Charlie. Come over here for a second." And they're going, "Charlie." And this little tiny 3-foot boy comes walking up to Jesus.
Yeah.
No kids are addressed in this patriarchal society. You do know that, right? You don't talk to kids in public in this day and age. Jesus did. "Hey, little Bobby, little Susie, come over here for a second." And all these disciples are going, "What is he doing? He's breaking all the rules." And he puts a kid up on his lap, and check it out. I'm going to read it for us. Jesus called a little child unto him and set him in the midst of them and said, "Truly, I say to you, except you be converted and become as little children, you shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven." Forget who's greatest. You won't even get in unless you humble yourself to that of a little child. He goes on. He doesn't stop there. "Whosoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, the same is greatest in the kingdom of heaven." There's so much to talk about, which we'll have to pick up there next week. But isn't that precious, guys? Jesus is showing these men who think their size, their stature, their success, their knowledge, their bank accounts, all this stuff, which, listen, that's what we look at in this room to determine greatness. And we have to admit it. We look at each other. We look at our possessions. We look at our lawns. We look at our muscles. We look at our beauty. We look at all our education, the way we carry ourselves away, and that is what we determine as humans equals greatness. And Jesus pukes on all of it and says, "Hey, little kid, come here. That's greatness. Because this kid is completely vulnerable, completely dependent on me, his Father in heaven, and he walks and operates in humility. He has nothing except to point to me and be completely dependent on me. So shame on us for this ongoing debate, 2,000 years old and crusty, by the way. We still argue about this. We still argue about who's the greatest pastor, who's the greatest elder, who's the greatest deacon, who's the greatest builder, who's the greatest fisherman, who's the greatest politician, who's the greatest mom, who's the best homemaker, who's the best homeschooler, who's the best laundryer, who's the best cook, potlucks. We are still consumed with who is the greatest. And Jesus would say to us this morning, none of you, the greatest in the kingdom is the little insignificant children downstairs that, by the way, it's really hard to get people to even go down there and serve them. It's really difficult to find people. That's a proving ground for ministry downstairs. Do a few months down there, I prove myself. Now, give me something great to do. And Jesus is like, "You just left it. It's 6 to 9-year-olds. It's dirty diapers." That's where the greatness happens, according to the head of the church, which I think we ought to listen to. But we bypass all that. And we want greatness, which means being up here. I've tried to demonstrate something for the last year and a half. Have it. I try to do my best to minimize me up here because I really think we need to swallow this lesson and digest it. I don't always have to be the one up front. And our church hasn't suffered that much. Only the people that come here for humans don't come here anymore, but the people that come here for Christ, they still come. Pretty cool, right? Get downstairs. We need a background check. Assuming that's good, get downstairs. and serve the kids and experience greatness according to Christ. It's not all about human recognition and human glory. It's about humbling ourselves and acknowledging the people that get stepped over often. Something to think about. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your word this morning and your goodness to us. And Lord, I pray that we wouldn't just dismiss this stuff from our minds, Lord, but we really would take a minute, digest it, ask you how you're speaking to us personally through all this, and respond, Lord. That is a Christian. Somebody who responds to your word, not a hearer only. I pray you'd produce that more and more in us. Lord, thank you for these people. I love all of them. I love what you've done here. I love the family that we have. Thank you that we can be at times harsh with each other. That's family. But it's for, I believe, the betterment of your church. So help us not to forget that either. We love you, Lord, and we ask your blessing on the day. And we ask all this in Jesus' name, amen.